From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Neil Young, the great rock singer and guitarist, has a current album that's his most popular in years. Also today, singer-songwriter Tish Hinojosa tells us about finding her musical voice. Her sound is a blend of folk, Tex-Mex, country, and traditional Mexican music. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Point of No Return, an American remake of the French film La Femme Nikita, Bridget Fonda stars. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. Supreme Court Justice Byron White says he plans to retire soon. White, who is generally viewed as a conservative voice on the court, says he'll step down at the end of the court's current term. NPR's John Greenberg has more.
Justice White released a statement today saying it has been an interesting and exciting experience to serve on the court, but it is time for someone else to have a turn. He will step down in June or July, giving the president plenty of time to name his replacement. President Clinton said that White's announcement came as a surprise and that he hasn't yet put together a list of potential nominees. He said he's looking for someone with a fine mind, wide experience in the law, and a big heart. White has served on the court for 31 years. His departure is expected to blunt the force of conservative opinion on the court. White is solidly against abortion rights, has generally opposed affirmative action, and has written that the Constitution does not protect homosexual conduct. His replacement is expected to pull the court into the political middle. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
As the debate in Congress continues over President Clinton's budget proposals, the government says the nation's deficit continues to grow. The Treasury Department says it spent $47 billion more than it collected in February, increasing the 1993 federal deficit to $138 billion for the first 5 months of fiscal 1993. Pentagon officials say Defense Secretary Les Aspin met with top aides today and should be out of the hospital this weekend. Aspin was hospitalized earlier this week and had a heart pacemaker implanted yesterday. Doctors say he's recovering quickly. Jubilant crowds lined the Bosnian town of Srebrenica after an aid convoy carrying desperately needed food and medicine finally managed to get through after being blocked by Serb forces for more than a week. The convoy was headed by the commander of United Nations forces in Bosnia, General Philippe Morion. The BBC's Jane Howard has this report from the Serbian capital of Belgrade.
UN officials inside Srebrenica said that people could hardly believe their eyes when the 17 aid trucks rumbled into town. Larry Hollingworth of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees described over a live radio link how people were clapping, cheering, waving, and crying. A UN spokesman in Geneva described General Morion's efforts as heroic. The general intervened personally after the trucks were blocked for more than a week by Bosnian Serb militiamen and Yugoslav Army soldiers. He negotiated the passage of the convoy, then led it over the border from Serbia into Bosnia without a military escort. At one point, Bosnian Serb gunmen opened fire with warning shots. But the trucks raced on at top speed. General Morion told reporters that he could not accept that the convoy was being blocked for bureaucratic reasons while women were dying.
That was Jane Howard reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed mixed today, gaining nearly 6 points to finish the day at 3471.58. Decliners led advances by 5-4. This is NPR News. The manufacturer of a controversial abortion pill says the pill will be tested on thousands of American women in hospitals and clinics. An official for the French firm Roussel Ouclef said that between 10 and 20,000 women will be involved in the trial. Details of the testing have not been released yet. The RU486 pill has faced major controversy in this nation, despite its use in a number of European nations. A federal advisory board today recommended that the Food and Drug Administration approve a new drug to treat multiple sclerosis, a debilitating nerve disease. The drug slows the progress of the disease in some patients, but it's not a cure. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
Multiple sclerosis occurs when the immune system turns against a person's own nerve cells. Researchers at a California biotechnology company called Chiron developed a drug to interfere with that destructive process. The drug is called beta interferon. Studies presented today at an FDA review panel showed that beta interferon reduces the number of flare-ups in some people. Drugs available now only treat the symptoms of multiple sclerosis, but they don't deal with the underlying ailment. So doctors are calling the new drug a significant advance. The Food and Drug Administration isn't obligated to follow recommendations from the review board, but it usually does. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
The Clinton administration has approved Oregon's controversial plan to ration health care to the poor as a way to expand coverage to more people. The plan ranks hundreds of medical procedures according to their costs and benefits. Some of the services that fall below the cutoff line include surgery to remove benign tumors of the digestive system, as well as therapy for chronic back disorders and nutritional counseling for obese people. The Bush administration refused to approve the Oregon plan last year, largely because of objections from disabled organizations who said that the plan would discriminate against their members. This is National Public Radio News from Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Neil Young's early records are played on classic rock stations, but he doesn't have to get by on nostalgia, and his music hasn't frozen in the past. Some of his recent music has been too adventurous and raw to get airplay on anything but college stations. Young is also eccentric and sometimes controversial. A few years ago, his video This Note's For You, a send-up of musicians who do beer and soda commercials, was banned by MTV and then went on to win their Video of the Year award. Young grew up in Canada. When he moved to L.A., he met Stephen Stills, and they formed Buffalo Springfield. He later sang with Stills in Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. Young has also led his own rock band, Crazy Horse. Neil Young's latest album, Harvest Moon, is his most popular record in recent years. He just performed a concert on MTV's Unplugged, and that's inspired us to replay this interview, which we recorded when the album was released last November. This is the title track, Harvest Moon.
Come a little bit closer, hear what I have to say. Just like children sleeping, we could dream this night. But there's a full moon rising, let's go dancing in the light. We know where the music's playing, let's go.
Neil Young, welcome to Fresh Air. What's the relation of the new album Harvest Moon to your earlier album Harvest?
Well, really, when I started making Harvest Moon, it was just a few songs, and I had four or five songs, so I had enough to do a session. And then I chose the musicians for the session based on those songs. And when I saw the list, I recognized it as the same people that I'd used on Harvest. And then, during the process of that, of course, we realized what we sounded like, and it sounded, you know, like the original record that we made a long time ago, but 20 years difference, you know.
It's interesting that you're returning, in a way, to an earlier style, especially after your recent live albums like Arc and Weld, which were really loud and filled with feedback and, you know, lots of, like, noise, interesting stuff, but very different than what you're doing now.
Well, this is really just a form of music that I return to, and it's evolving. It's more evolved this time than it was the last time I returned to it, so I figure the same thing will happen on the other side with the grungier things that I've been doing with my electric music. when I come back to that in the future someday, I imagine I'll just take off from where I was the last time I was there, you know.
A few years ago on My My Hey Hey, you sung that it's better to burn out than fade away. Do you still feel that way?
Well, as far as what I do, I think it's better that I do it as hard as I can and then either stop or, you know, for whatever reason, not do it anymore. But to just let the energy kind of die is... that's not what I want to do. So that's what I'm talking about with that phrase there.
What's your idea of burning out? I mean, what are some of the things that you feel you've done that risked getting you to a point of burnout, but meant?
Well, I think almost everything I've done that a lot of the things I've done have gotten me to that point. That's why I get that far, and then instead of continuing and letting the energy slide away, I just stop and do something else rather than, just kind of let the thing lose its intensity and kind of back down.
Is that where you are with this album? Was this album a kind of stopping after the more hard sound of Ark and Well?
After the last three or four albums, which have had a lot of distortion and a lot of loud sounds and everything, I kind of felt like... you know, especially after the experience of playing the Ragged Glory tour, which produced the last live album, after the experience of doing that and playing during the Persian Gulf War and playing at exceedingly loud levels with really bombastic and kind of violent-sounding, explosive waves of grunge, you know, all this stuff, and kind of standing in the middle of that wondering whether I was going to get blown over or whatever, you know, after doing it for 90 nights or whatever we did it, 90 days anyway. I was just at a point where I wanted to kind of go the other way and play as quiet as I could and just play something really soothing and really easy to physically handle, not so much in any mental release, but the physicalness of listening to something real soft, so that's what I was looking for there, and I made sure we all played as quiet as possible in the studio, so you could almost have a conversation over any of the tracks that we were playing when we were playing them. We weren't trying to be powerful in the sense of loud. We were just real quiet.
You know, it's interesting, most of the people who play, that kind of like loud grunge sound are much younger. And I wonder how you felt as somebody in his 40s who's been recording since the mid-60s, playing a music that mostly people who are, you know, a generation or so younger than you.
None of these old guys around know how to do it.
None of the old guys know how to do it?
No, they don't. They can't do it, so, you know, they don't do it. That's why I'm still doing it, because I know how. If they were as lucky as me, they'd be doing it too. I mean, it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
There's no sensation like that.
What does it feel like?
It feels great. I mean, you're in the middle of this thing. It's all around you. It surrounds you. It's an amazing sound. You know, grunge started before I started playing. I mean, Link Wray started. He was one of the earliest of this type of music, with a song called Rumble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember.
And several other songs. And he combined with Lonnie Mack, who did Wham and Memphis back in the early 60s. That was the beginning of this stuff.
You were in high school bands. Did you sing in those bands?
After the beginning, I did. I started as an instrumentalist. We used to do songs, instrumentals that I used to write, you know, melodies and play them on the guitar, sort of like a group called The Shadows from England. And then after the English invasion, you know, and also about the same time as Jimmy Reed became popular, the old blues man Jimmy Reed with going to New York and...
Bright Lights, Big City.
Yeah, Beeping and Hyde and all these things, you know, He about the same time as the British invasion, all these groups singing harmony and playing guitars and everything. Both of those things happened to me at once, so I really couldn't figure out who it was that made me want to sing, but one of them, you know, or both of them at the same time. And I started singing, and that was like a milestone
What do you mean?
People couldn't believe it, apparently. I don't remember it, but I was so into it, I guess I didn't notice that everybody was going, what is that? You know, as I was starting to sing. Of course, now I'm like, you know, Caruso or something. Got it down.
Were you self-conscious about your voice when you started to sing?
No, not really. I never really, I was just glad to be singing. I mean, we could do a lot more songs if I sang them.
No one else in the band could sing?
No. Nobody in the band could sing. Not nobody else in the band. Nobody in the band. So we did harmony, and we did everything, you know, but it didn't matter.
Now, you say that you weren't self-conscious about your singing, but there are stories about how, you know, like in your first solo album, you intentionally mixed yourself in the background.
No, I mixed myself right up there where I should be, and then they tried out this new scientific process that they'd invented called the CSG Heiko-Cog process, which is this unbelievable thing where you can make a stereo record play back on a mono machine just like it was a mono record. They did something to the sound back then. This is when stereo was just coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And there were, you know, a lot of people had mono sets, and the stereo didn't sound right on the mono set. So they came out with this thing. You run it through this machine that this guy made, this little box or something, and it would make it so you could play it both stereo or mono. But in reality, I was a test case for this with my first album. They did this without letting me know. And they put it out like that, and I got the pressings back, and I went, what happened, you know? Then I read this thing that had been added on the album cover where this, with this engineering note that this had employed this technique. And really, it was the worst thing I ever heard. I mean, they just buried the whole center of the record and put it way down. And this, I think they only used it on my record. They decided it didn't work after that.
So it wasn't self-consciousness that was behind
it? No.
That.
I can look at the next record. My vocal is right up there.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about being in a tight harmony group like Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young?
How did they feel about it? That's the question. It was no longer a tight harmony group.
Do you like being in a harmony like that? I mean, I love your voice. I consider it a very personal voice. Do you know what I mean? A voice that should be singing on its own more so than just like mixed in a harmony.
Well, you know, I like singing harmony too. I sing good harmony with Crazy Horse.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sense in there that, you know, because there's a couple of different ways to sing harmony, you know, and you can, or blends of all of them. But one of them is just real tight harmony, and the other one is where everybody's singing just more or less just singing loose, but in a harmonic structure with a lot of feeling. That's a different kind of harmony, and that's the kind of harmony that I do with Crazy Horse quite a bit. Sometimes we're real successful at that.
My guest is Neil Young. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Neil Young, if you're just joining us. And he, by the way, has a new album called Harvest Moon. So you came from Canada to Los Angeles, became part of Buffalo Springfield, and I guess it was in 66, you have a really big hit, For What It's Worth. And then, you know, people just like loved Buffalo Springfield. This is like the height or the beginnings of the height of the whole kind of counterculture, which is really thriving, particularly on the West Coast. And so suddenly, like, you're really in the thick of it. I mean, you'd gone from what, a small town in Canada, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a half a million people, something like that.
Uh-huh. And now, like, you're really in the thick of it. Did you change a lot? Were you, like, a kind of different person than you were?
Well, you know, I think it affected me. I think it got to be a lot of pressure for a while. But, you know, we got through that after freaking out and quitting the band a couple of times and, you know, throwing my guitar against the chair and doing all kinds of stuff. You know, we went through a normal kind of teenage to adult changeover period there.
When you throw your guitar against the chair, do you? In the days when you did that, was it? Were you sure you had money to replace it?
No, that was the point.
Before you threw it?
No.
No, I think I didn't do that every day, but it's just part, I guess, the pressure of being in the band and trying to make things happen. Yeah.
We did a lot of things like that. I mean, what, we were 20, 21 years old. We were kind of crazy for a while, and then, you know, just like anybody else under a lot of pressure. Bunch of kids, you know, was a pretty fast-moving time.
What's something that you look back on and still find really exciting about that period?
Well, the music was great, and it's too bad it was never recorded correctly, or it would have, you know, the Buffalo Springfield would have been far more of a memory than they are now.
What's missing?
The music is missing. There was, you know, this was about the time when people started making records by overdubbing, and new technology was coming in. We had like 8 tracks, we had ways of doing things that weren't that made it possible to layer records, and so instead of going in the studio and singing live like we were so great live, the people producing us, they didn't record us the way they should have. If they had just set us up and let us record live, this band would be band probably would have been together and stayed together a lot longer, because we would have had much more success and had a lot more happiness from listening to our records, and, you know, felt like we were getting something done. But at the beginning, it was kind of hard to break through. We still didn't know how to make records, and we didn't have anybody that knew how to make records helping us make records. And instead, we had people who wanted to be record producers for one reason or another, who were there, but they really weren't doing anything. Nobody strong came along and said, listen, you guys go in there and sing, and when I tell you to come out and stop playing and singing, then come on in here and it'll sound great. Nobody ever did that. So I feel that was a failing of the Buffalo Springfield, was all the records. There was only Ahmed Erdogan really had a grip on what should be, what the Springfield records should sound like.
What sounds best to you now from those records?
I don't have a favorite.
Okay. I thought I'd play Mr. Soul. What are your memories of that?
Well, the memories of that are the best take of it and the best mix of it and the best version of it is somewhere in the Atlantic vault.
Right.
And the one that we're listening to here is one that where we got away from it, and we kept overdubbing and overdubbed guitar parts and added things over top of the original stuff and lost some of the original stuff. And we took it too far. We didn't have anybody to tell us to go home or tell us that had experience telling us what to do. So we lost a lot of the great stuff that we had on tape in the first place, or that we never got a lot of it on tape at all.
Okay, well, in the meantime, we'll satisfy ourselves with the actually released version of Mr. Soul. Your song The Needle and the Damage Done, which is also from the Harvest album, was written for Danny Whitten, who was the guitarist in Crazy Horse, and he had overdosed. What was the impact of you on that, of his death?
Well, you know, I think everybody was devastated by it, everybody in the band, and we were all... No, we all felt very sad. It was a great loss to us. So we managed to turn it into music. That's all we can do with it.
Right. I want to play the song Tonight's the Night. Would you say something about writing this and what you were thinking about during this period?
I really don't remember what I was thinking about during the period. I know that the stuff all came out real fast, and that I just was immersed in this thing. I'd, It had stayed inside me for a while. It had been, I think, well, what did we do? We did Tonight's the Night right after Time Fades Away. Time Fades Away was the tour that Danny was rehearsing for, and then didn't go. So, I mean, he didn't go on the tour. He went somewhere else. So, you know, that's... This was sort of like a wake or something, I guess, the Tonight's the Night record, because the people that I played it with were the people that we played with Danny, and Danny knew, and we were all his friends. That was just one of those moments, you know, we just went for it.
This is Neil Young.
Tonight's the night. Tonight's the night. A sparkle was in his eye, but his life was in his hand. Well, late at night when the people were gone, he used to pick up my guitar and sing a song in a shaky voice that was real as the day was long. Tonight's the night, yes it is. Tonight's the night. Tonight's the night, yes it is. Tonight's the night. Early in the morning at the break of...
Neil Young is my guest, and that's Tonight's the Night. Neil Young has a new album called Harvest Moon. And I know you have two sons who have cerebral palsy. Your doctors have said that it's not related and that it's just one of the most incredible coincidences. Have you ever found out anything about that?
Well, my life has been a series of incredible coincidences and extreme things that have happened to me. So I feel, you know, I'm lucky to get where I am and everything. You know, my life's been funny like that, so...
What else strikes you as being that extreme or coincidental?
Just the whole thing, you know. I can't go into detail, but look where I am now. I mean, I started off where hundreds of thousands of other kids started off, you know.
I mean, just in high school bands?
Yeah. Now a lot of them are working in department stores. I mean, you know, I don't, you know, it's been an unusual life for me. I'm very happy that things worked out the way they have.
Neil Young. Our interview was recorded last November. His latest album is Harvest Moon. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
From Hank to Hendrix, I walk these streets with you. Here I am with this old guitar, doing what I do. You would see me through. I never believed in much, but I believed in you. Can we get it together? Can we still stand side by side?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Singer-songwriter Tish Hinojosa is said to mine the musical legacy of the Lone Star State. Hinojosa combines Tex-Mex, country, Western folk, and traditional Mexican music. Coming up, we meet her and hear some of her songs. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Point of No Return, the American remake of the French thriller La Femme Nikita. The remake stars Bridget Fonda. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton says that he will start working tomorrow to find a replacement for Supreme Court Justice Byron White, who has announced he's stepping down from the nation's highest court. On a trip to Georgia today to gain support for his economic plan, Mr. Clinton promised that his nominee would be in place when the high court begins its new session in the fall. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
President Clinton said today he would pick a successor for Justice White, who has a fine mind, good judgment, and a wide experience in law and in the problems of real people. He added he also wants someone with a big heart. The president laughed when he was asked whether New York Governor Mario Cuomo fit the bill. During the campaign, he said Cuomo would make a superb Supreme Court justice. Asked whether he would use a person's position on abortion rights as a litmus test, the president responded that the question contains 1,000 questions, but it's a question that conservatives and liberals alike will be asking as he considers a nominee. White is a conservative centrist who wrote the dissenting opinion in the Roe v. Wade abortion rights case. He is currently the only justice on the 9-member panel who was appointed by a Democratic president. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Atlanta.
President Clinton has praised action by House lawmakers approving his economic programs as indicating that government can work. On a near party line vote, the $1.5 trillion budget for 1994 was approved by the House late last night. And early this morning, approval came on an economic stimulus plan. However, in the Senate, there is more opposition to the president's short-term spending plans and tax increases than in the House. And the budget outline approved by the House is not binding. Congress will vote later this year on what taxes are raised and what programs are curtailed. The Clinton administration has given Oregon permission to revamp its Medicaid system. The plan has stirred controversy because it restricts the kind of health care Medicaid recipients may receive. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
For years, Oregon has been trying to radically restructure its Medicaid program so the state can pay the medical bills for an additional 120,000 poor people. Under the plan, the state would no longer pay for care it considered costly and ineffective. That approach was considered a possible model for national reform. But the Bush administration rejected the plan after advocates for the disabled said it discriminated against the handicapped. Today, Secretary of Health and Human Services Donna Shalala told Oregon to go ahead, but with a few conditions intended to prevent discrimination. The state intends to comply with the conditions, but still has to find the millions of dollars it will need to pay for the program. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 6 points to close at 3,471.58 on volume of more than 294 million shares. This is NPR News. According to UN officials, an aid convoy has finally reached an area of eastern Bosnia where thousands of people have been without food and medicine for weeks. UN officials estimate some 30 people are dying each day in the region, mostly from cold and hunger. Because of recent Serbian bombing attacks, Britain has announced it will support UN action to enforce a no-fly zone over Bosnia. This comes one day after the State Department pushed for enforcement action. Britain and France have been hesitating because of fear the Serbians might strike back by targeting their forces on the ground. In Colombia, police and military troops in Medellin have killed a security aide to drug trafficker Pablo Escobar. Officials also apprehended two men who apparently planned to set off car bombs in Colombia's cities this weekend. Leslie Werpsa reports.
Lawyers who work for drug trafficker Pablo Escobar say their client is ready to surrender again, but joint strike teams of police and military troops have continued to search for the drug baron, conducting over 8,000 raids in Medellin, where they believe Escobar is hiding. Police officials said today's killing of Escobar's personal security chief, Mario Alberto Castaño, is a hard blow to the boss of the Medellin drug ring. Castaño had been accused of the 1988 murder of Colombia's attorney general, and he allegedly coordinated teams of hitmen paid to assassinate police officers in Medellin. Two other hitmen arrested last night admitted they were planning a string of bombings this weekend to pressure the government into negotiating with Escobar. Whether Escobar is caught or surrenders, he faces at least 16 charges for murder, kidnapping, and terrorism. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Werpsa in Bogota.
U.S. Coast Guard officials in the Netherlands say that a Japanese-owned tanker exploded and caught fire in the North Sea, killing at least one sailor. The tanker is carrying toxic chemicals, but so far there have been no reports of leakage from the Japanese-owned ship. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The 7th annual South by Southwest Music Conference is underway in Austin, Texas. It's a showcase for emerging talent and for performers who don't neatly fit into commercial categories. My guest, Tish Hinojosa, performed last night at the conference. Austin is where she lives. There was a time when she tried to fit into the country music genre. She moved to Nashville, but had no success with her music there. Then she moved back to the Southwest, where she let all of her influences come out, country, folk, Tex-Mex, and traditional Mexican music. That's when her music started catching on. Hinojosa grew up in San Antonio, the youngest of 13 children born to Mexican immigrant parents. You can hear the regional influence in the music and lyric of this song by the Rio Grande from her latest album, Culture Swing, featured as the great accordion player Flaco Jimenez. Did your Mexican heritage and your Latino influence in your music get in the way in Nashville? Was that a side of you that people in the music industry weren't interested in hearing?
Well, you know, it wasn't something I was looking for. I wasn't looking for discrimination or for someone to look at me only a certain way because I was Hispanic. But I began to see it, and it was a strange realization for me because, to me, my history, my Hispanic history, was just such a natural part of my music that it seemed like it was going to fit in wherever I went. But I did begin to see that they just have one perception of the Hispanic, you know, character. They have and it's pretty obvious by what they've signed over the last, you know, whatever history of country music is. It was always flowery Spanish songs or songs about, you know, senoritas on the border or about getting drunk and drinking tequila and that kind of stuff. You know, there was always just the, you know, real obvious stereotypes. And mine was just either, you know, songs I was beginning to write at the time. And I'm talking this is probably the mid-'80s. It was beginning to be pretty obvious that I was going to have to be totally homogenous, maybe even changing my last name and just being like a country singer. And if some music row writer happened to write something with some Spanish lyrics in it that they thought were appropriate, you know, I would be someone obvious to sing because I could speak the language. And I began to realize that I was being seen as a very, or my culture was being seen as a, through a very narrow perspective.
I think this would be a good time to play one of your country songs, just to hear your sound in country music. This is a song that you wrote called In the Real West. Would you like to say something about the song?
Well, that song was influenced by the cowboying life that I introduced myself to somewhere around that time, between Nashville and New Mexico is where I spent my time. Having grown up in San Antonio and being pretty sheltered for like 22 years, I finally just took off somewhere totally different by myself. And northern New Mexico was that place that I went to, and I learned so many different cultures up there, the Native American culture, the old hippies from the 60s who had settled up in the Taos area. And the ones that really fascinated me was the real working cowboys from the ranches. And so to some people it seemed might seem a little strange that this girl from Texas didn't discover cowboys until her 20s, but it's pretty true. I mean, when you're a city girl, you could be a city girl anywhere. And that's sort of the basis of this song is about me, my fascination or infatuation with the cowboying life.
It's the way of life in the real West, 'neath the prairie moon that's heaven blessed, and a tall bird shuffled on a wooden floor. It's a clean white shirt on a Saturday night, and a long cold beer is pure delight. And if you heard me say it, well, there's a whole lot more. It's the way of life in the real West. I'm a city girl, but I must confess I'd be a cowboy angel, and I know it for.
That's Tish Hinojosa from her new album, Culture Swing. When you were growing up and listening to music on the radio, did the music that was sung in Spanish have a completely different sound to you than the other music you were listening to?
Yeah, it did. And something that has played a large part in my memories, as well as playing a large part in my music now, is the having the Spanish radio on in the kitchen on constantly. And this radio was just fascinating because it was different than the American radio programming of, let's say, the early 60s, that the Spanish radio still had programming like old American radio. It was live radio shows. It was variety shows on radio. It was like the hour of the old Mexican classics with Agustin Lara or Maria Grieber songs. And one ear was always bent to the kitchen, particularly at these late hour times, like let's say 8 or 9 or 10 o'clock, where they would have a particular hour of a certain kind of music. And on the other hand, my sisters in their transistor radios in their bedrooms, I could be hearing that pop music of the early 60s and, the Beatles making their entrance. And it was hearing within the same house, hearing these two really different cultural radios coming in to do two different years. And I was just, I loved both of them very, very strongly. I guess the Mexican radio, because it was my attachment, let's say, to my mother that, I felt very strongly about. And then the other one was just a fascination with the big world out there that was yet to be, that was yet to be discovered.
Singer-songwriter Tish Hinojosa is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tish Hinojosa. When you write a song in Spanish and when you sing that song in Spanish, does it bring out different qualities in your songwriting and your singing?
Yeah, the Spanish language is very, it's a very rolling, soft, poetic language. And I find it easy to write in. And actually singing-wise, it almost brings out a much richer texture in the voice. than singing in English does. You know, you almost say a lot more with the music and the sound of the voice than you do with the words.
Let me play one of your Spanish songs. Why don't we hear Corazón Viajero, which means wandering heart. Would you like to talk about this song, what it says, or why you wrote it?
Yeah, the song is it's a sort of introspective look at growing old and realizing that the young people aren't the only ones who have ever been in love, that there's some very rich love stories that you know, many old, you know, when, hopefully when we're old, we'll be able to look back and remember particular strong loves that we had in our life. And it's a respect for our elderly and where they've been.
Cualquier persona en cualquier lugar sabe un cuento de amores. Se guarda dentro para recordar y así se pasan los su fiel pasar, regresan a reconocer. Ahí te espero, pero primero este cuento de un soñar. Sin dar razón, se dio pasión.
It's Tishy Nohosa from her album Culture Swing. Now, I think you started your music career singing Spanish jingles for the radio?
Mm-hmm.
What, commercials?
Yeah, it was local Texas commercials mostly, but my mother was the one that I always give credit for that because, you know, my mother had a very strong work ethic, and when she'd see me sitting around the house playing my guitar, you know, she'd want to know what my plans were. And I said, well, I don't know. You know, I just know that I like to do this. And so she called the Mexican radio station up and said, look, I've got this daughter. She sings. You know, can you do something with her? So they said, yeah, send her on down here. So I went down to the radio station and auditioned for them. And from there, you know, they hired me. I was about probably 16 or 17 years old. I began singing jingles for that radio station and, you know, commercials they would do on their radio. And from there came my first record deal, which was a Mexican record company in San Antonio.
So singing jingles on the radio is what led to your first record contract.
Right.
Which was for a regional Latino label.
Actually, it was the start of what now is a very strong company there. I was the very first artist for Robert Griever. The first time this guy heard me at the Mexican radio station, he immediately, what came to mind with him was a Joan Baez. And to me, that was very flattering. So we found a song that he had access to, which was an old Paul Simon song that a friend of ours put Spanish lyrics to because it was about a Hispanic man who was searching for his identity. It's a song called Carlos Dominguez, which I finally did put on my Spanish record last year, Aquella Noche. But it was supposed to be my first single with him. And it was a very, you know, very obviously, you know, folk song of social meaning and stuff. But he said, well, first let's start with this, though. So I put out four singles of Mexican bubblegum pop music first. And we never did come around to the Paul Simon song. And at that point, I got a little bit disillusioned because it wasn't the Spanish, the language part of the music that was bothering me. It was the style that, you know, it was okay, but by now I was like 18 years old and, you know, I was really into the folk scene and all this, and it just didn't seem natural to me to be singing bubblegum music that made me sound like I was 15 years old, and that wasn't what I wanted to be doing.
What were the bubblegum songs like?
They were very, pop-oriented, very like AM pop radio. I guess like what teen singers or what you probably hear, you know, like Tiger Beat magazine kind of artist. it was cute, but, you know, very, very fluffy and just not a lot of context.
Would you want to sing a couple of bars of one of the songs?
Let's see, what do I have? Una vez te di mi amor. Con da 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 con loca pasión yo pensé que me querías y nunca quise pensar que tu amor no era de verdad que tu amor me fuera engañar. You know, kind of the early 60s girl singer kind of stuff.
Right, right. So, you know the Mexican radio station that you started off doing jingles for?
Mm-hmm.
Are they still on the air?
Oh, yeah. They're still, you know, I really love that station. It's KCOR in San Antonio.
Do they play your records?
Probably not. because I understand what they're, you know, they're like, to them, you know, it's a... They're like what a real strong bluegrass station would be to bluegrass. I mean, they you almost have to be totally dedicated to that kind of music, and they have to know that you have a lifelong commitment to them. And I do, but they don't know it yet. I'm waiting for them to come around because there's two or three songs I've written that I know would fit their programming, but I think as an overall artist, they might think that I'm maybe just a little bit too anglicized or too. Because I don't just do that. I have other tastes and stuff, and they want lifelong commitments. You know, for their kind of music, and because I can't give them that, and I won't. I'll just wait for them to plug in whenever they want to plug in.
Tisha, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Tish Hinojosa's latest album, Culture Swing, is on Rounder Records. She spells her last name Hinojosa. This is Fresh Air. Justice Byron White announced today that he'll be retiring. Robert Siegel, what do you have to say about that on All Things Considered?
Well, reporter John Greenberg is covering the story, and we'll hear from him what impact the retirement is likely to have on the Supreme Court. Justice White has been a critical vote against the Roe v. Wade decision, and President Clinton has said he wants to appoint a justice who will support abortion rights. This could be a very pivotal change in that regard. Also, reporter Lynn Terry reports from Paris on the French parliamentary elections, in which over this weekend the French socialists are expected to lose and lose big. We'll hear why and what's likely to happen next. Also, Barbarians at the Gate, a book about R.J.R. Nabisco, is an HBO movie this weekend. We'll hear from one of the book's authors about what in the movie is fact and what's fiction.
Thanks, Robert. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's only March, and already 1993 has brought us three Hollywood remakes of European films. The Vanishing vanished almost immediately. Summersby has turned out to be a small-scale hit. And now comes Point of No Return, a remake of Luc Besson's hit La Femme Nikita. It's directed by John Badham, who made War Games, Saturday Night Fever, and The Hard Way. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Point of No Return is just as stupid as La Femme Nikita, and it's just as glossy as La Femme Nikita. But it also has something that La Femme Nikita didn't have. It has Bridget Fonda. La Femme Nikita starred Anne Perriot, who was a beautiful, leggy pop object, but not exactly an actress. Bridget Fonda is not only an actress, she's one of the two or three most exciting screen presences of her generation. Even in repose, she makes you feel that something is always ticking inside her, that there are a dozen choices she might make, all of them invigorating or surprising. And in taking what amounts to a female Arnold Schwarzenegger role, she's making a very shrewd career move. Point of No Return could be a hit, the kind of hit that spawns sequels, which in turn could provide Fonda with the kind of box office clout that would let her pursue the more challenging roles she's already demonstrated a preference for. Meanwhile, though, she's playing Maggie, a murderous young junkie who kills a Washington cop and is sentenced to die for it. But her execution turns out to be a fake. Instead, a mysterious government organization offers her a deal. Either they go ahead and execute her, this time for real, or else she allows them to train her to become a top-flight assassin. Her chief trainer is Bob, played by Gabriel Byrne, who doesn't realize the toll her new job is taking on her until one day she tells him she wants out.
You stupid, ignorant little girl. Do you think you can just pout and decide you don't want to play anymore? Haven't you heard anything that I've said?
I mean it.
You don't know what you're talking about.
I'm through. I'm out.
Listen, which word do you not understand? There is no out. There is no through. There is no out.
Bob, you gotta help me. I can't do this. I can't live like this anymore. Don't you like me well enough to help me?
Like you.
I know you like that you made me into something different. But you're not looking close enough. I am different. Help me be better. Please, Bob, let me go.
John Badham is a proficient hack director, and he's made a film that really moves. But Point of No Return is still irredeemably sleazy. Here, after all, is a movie about a street thug who becomes a sleek super killer, and the film depicts that transformation as some sort of awakening. In making her one of the most efficient murderers on Earth, the government has rehabilitated her, has made her more refined, sexier, better company. The movie makes a romance of slaughter, and it also gives Fonda's Maggie complete impunity. Looking sensational in a little black dress, she waltzes into the chicest restaurant in Washington, whips out a gun the size of your head, kills a diplomat and his bodyguard and about five other people, all without apparently arousing a single headline, a single police inquiry, or even a single witness. The movie might work if it had the tongue-in-cheek tone of a James Bond film or the comic book quality of a Schwarzenegger shoot-em-up, but Point of No Return is played perfectly straight. It asks you to accept its dream girl with a gun fantasy at face value. Still, if you're a Bridget Fonda fan who hates to see her in a piece of gimmicky claptrap like this, don't be disheartened. After all, her Aunt Jane made Barbarella.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Richard Parker, and Bob Alls. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, math as a way to civil rights. We talk with Bob Moses. 30 years ago, he was a leader of the civil rights movement in Mississippi, registering voters. Now he's opening opportunities for young African-American students with his innovative algebra project. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.